It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Thanks to listener requests, Liz in Chicago, we had an email from Jay. We explore the work of prairie restoration underway in Wisconsin through the nonprofit grassroots group, the Prairie Enthusiasts. Call in with a question. You can share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dan Carter is an ecologist with the Prairie Enthusiasts. Dan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Good morning. And Deborah Behrens is here, the organization's executive director. Deborah, welcome.
Thank you so much, Kate. Good morning.
Good morning. Deborah, let's start with you. Why are you passionate about protecting prairie and savanna ecosystems in Wisconsin and the upper Midwest?
Well, for me personally, this is a calling that came a little later in life. I have pioneer ancestors who are farmers in Minnesota, and I grew up as a child visiting my grandparents on the farm. And I thought of the prairie as that vast sky, the agricultural fields that we drove through to get to their place on the in the southern part of Minnesota. And as I continued to learn about the prairie over a lifetime, I developed a deepening interest in what the prairie really was when my pioneer ancestors arrived. And my husband and I developed an interest in restoration and eventually relocated from the Twin Cities to southwestern Wisconsin, where we're doing our own restoration on our land now.
I remember that first time that I stepped on prairie that had been untouched. It was a summer in North Dakota on my family grandmother's former land. And I just, the feeling to wash over you and to look out over a prairie, there's something that is just so remarkable. And Dan, I'm wondering what calls you to this work of prairie conservation?
Well, for me, it probably started when I was a teenager. I used to like to go on bike rides out in the country. I grew up in Iowa, and I had no awareness of prairie. But one day when I was out on a bike ride, I stopped at a small county property, which was a prairie preserve, and I got off my bike and I walked around, and it just blew my mind, you know, what was there. It was a place that was full of things that I had never seen before, that was just right there in the place that I'd been at to that point, you know, living my entire life.
Mm. So how would you describe, Dan, the state of prairie ecosystems now in Wisconsin?
Well, I would say there's sort of both really good news and bad news. I'll start with the really good news and that's that there are prairies in Wisconsin that are very healthy, whose condition has been maintained and even improved over the last several decades, even with stresses like climate change and everything else. But prairies are an ecosystem type, and really prairies and oak savannas and oak woodlands and all the other fire-dependent ecosystems are ecosystem types that require a human interaction, and most prominent there is the use of prescribed fire, and presently we're really lacking the capacity to implement that adequately on the remaining prairies and other fire dependent communities in the state. So we're losing a lot of prairies even in protected settings on lands that are in conservation ownership, simply because we don't have the resources to implement that kind of stewardship.
And we're going to go more deeply into prescribed burns in just a bit. But Deborah, the Prairie Enthusiast has chapters in Wisconsin and Illinois and Minnesota. How does the organization work with farmers and landowners to conserve prairies?
So that is a great question. We love working with farmers and landowners. Going back to the 70s, when we originally formed, it was a small group of volunteers who were finding each other through their mutual interest and passion for prairie. And they were seeking out where some of these remnant prairie ecosystems still existed in the state. And many of them were on land that was owned by agricultural families. And they would go door to door. They would walk up and knock on the door and say, hello, I think you have remnant prairie on your land. Mm-hmm. Can I talk to you about it? Can I show you what's there and learn about, you know, how you're managing it? And we've developed generations-long, sometimes, relationships with those families where we're collaborating to help care for what is really an endangered, imperiled ecosystem in the state. And over time, because we're an accredited land trust now, we have been able to protect some of those prairies and now continue to care for them. So that's one really important way that we've worked with farmers and landowners. Increasingly, we see private landowners who themselves are looking at the lands that they hold and purchasing them for the purpose of restoration, or purchasing them because they have a desire to be in nature. And they start to seek out, what is the right way for me to be managing my land if I want to be a responsible landowner? They find us. And Dan's position in the organization is actually funded by donor support, and he visits with those landowners to learn what their goals are for the land, to talk with them about what tools are available to help them achieve their goals, and in some cases to develop some plans alongside them to achieve those goals.
Deborah Behrens there, and Dan Carter of the nonprofit The Prairie Enthusiasts, as we talk about conservation of prairies in the upper Midwest. Call in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Dan, as you do your work as an ecologist, which animals are most threatened by the loss of prairie and savannas?
Well, there's a group, especially of insects, that really specialize on prairie species and are only found in remnant prairies. Things like regal fritillary butterflies, certain plant hoppers. A lot of these, they're specialized to the particular biochemistry of native plants that are in those prairies. And oftentimes these are plants that don't occur anywhere else on the landscape. And given how fragmented the landscape is now, many of these species have limited ability to colonize new sites, say where prairie is reconstructed, even if they do have suitable host plants. So the specialist insects are a huge one. If we think about larger landscapes, of course, there are species that we've lost on most of the prairie landscape, things like the greater prairie chicken or the grassland birds that require large tracts of open grassland, whether it's prairie or not, frankly. But those are groups that come to mind, the grassland birds and the specialist insects.
Deborah, we hear you talking about remnant prairies and this emphasis on sites that are undisturbed from development. Why are these remnant sites so important, so valuable?
So we think of saving the planet and caring about what's happening in the rainforest. And certainly we have to think globally, but it's easy to forget because we've lost our memory for the prairie. As Dan mentioned, the systems have become increasingly fragmented. What the prairie was and how important it was and still is to this region where we live today. Less than 1% of the original prairie and oak savanna that was here when European settlers arrived is still here today. That's an incredibly threatened system. And as Dan mentioned, there's biodiversity depending on the continued existence and health of these systems. So we actively seek out and protect, which includes the management of what we call fire-dependent systems, because they evolved over thousands of years relying on the fires lit mostly by indigenous peoples in the region. And we try to, in protecting that land, then return fire to the land and bring back the human part of the ecosystem and the care for that system. You know, we think of humans as often being the culprit, creating environmental damage. that actually humans play a really important part in restoring and maintaining the health of these systems.
Deborah Behrens leads the Prairie Enthusiasts, and Dan Carter is an ecologist with the organization, and you can be part of this discussion about bringing back and caring for native prairie land. Call in with a question, add comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss native prairie restoration efforts here in Wisconsin as the organization, the Prairie Enthusiasts, open a 4-day virtual conference on different facets of land conservation. Call in with a question. You can share your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Deborah Behrens is executive director of the Prairie Enthusiasts, and Dan Carter is an ecologist with the group. Dan, in terms of the conference, there will be events on training people to be crew members during a prescribed burn. How do people train for these burns?
Yeah, so we offer training for our volunteers, and training is really important. And so in the conference, it's a virtual training, and people after that can meet up with local chapters and get oriented to the equipment that's used. But, you know, we use prescribed burning. It's something different from wildland fire. And so we offer a curriculum that's really focused on the ecological reasons we burn, the history of fire in the region, and the way fire behaves when it's implemented in a prescribed burn in our Midwestern prairie and other fire-dependent ecosystems. And we really rely on volunteers in most instances on the places we protect to implement burns. And so it's very important for us to continue to maintain that reservoir of capacity, because that's really one of the most limiting things that that limits the broader ability to protect and conserve prairie and other fire-dependent ecosystems.
What might be some of the tasks that these volunteers do as part of the prescribed burn?
Oh, well, everything. we have volunteers with lots of experience and who have taken our training and additional trainings to become burn bosses, so lead burns. Volunteers coordinate burns, lead crews on the burns, perform ignition activities, so, you know, light the fire, hold the line. So we have fire breaks around burn units, and volunteers, you know, sort of position themselves along those breaks with water and other equipment to ensure that the fire is held within the burn unit and doesn't pass over the fire break. But really, it's all the jobs.
Hmm. Let's take a call now. Tom in Green Bay is here. Tom, hi.
Good morning. I'm curious if your guest has any comments or any ideas in overcoming some of the social resistance to suburban or urban prairies around homes. I know that they're often not popular in neighborhoods when people turn their lawns into prairies. Personally, I like them, and I, you know, love what they do for the critters, but I also understand the neighbors' perspectives, and if the guest has any ideas to overcome that.
Tom, thank you. Deborah.
So that is a great question. We actually have a remnant prairie that is in a community that has expanded, and so now surrounding our community are some family homes. And we have had some mixed experience with that. On the one hand, there are some people who are really curious about what's happening there and even get involved and bring their children, and it's a wonderful enrichment. For others, there is concern about the wildlife on the prairie and some of the activity that we're doing. So we really strive to communicate about what the plans are for management and to educate to the extent that that's possible about what we're doing and why these systems are important. But I think actually it might be interesting to hear from Dan on this as well, because he has been doing some active prairie gardens in his own, where he lives near Milwaukee.
Oh, okay. Dan, what has come through those?
Yeah, so I would reiterate that communication is important. I live in a subdivision on about a 3/4 acre lot, and it really stands out because just about every square inch of it has been planted to prairie and oak savanna vegetation, and it's not mowed or anything. And you know, I put up signs, I talk to my neighbors. It's also important, I think, to, there are different ways of going about doing it. And maybe I have the benefit of being an ecologist that works in these systems and have some understanding of how they're stitched together, but simply what plants are used and how they're combined and what the results are important. So there's an annual sort of rummage sale in my area, and tons of people are coming from all over the place and parking along our street. And I'm often working out in my yard. It's the weekend, and people come up and strike up a conversation, but they just say, "Oh, you have a really nice garden," because it's just this, it's just a bunch of flowers, and there aren't any weeds that they recognize. And it has a structure that's a lot like the structure in Remnant Prairies, because I manage it very intensively.
Oh, all the teachable moments. Yeah.
So, you know, to some people that don't understand maybe even that I'm working with prairie vegetation, they just see it as a really nice garden.
Interesting. Dan Carter of the Prairie Enthusiasts, Deborah Behrens, Executive Director, as we discuss prairies in the Upper Midwest and their conservation. Call in with questions, 800-642-1234. Kevin in Janesville. Kevin, hi.
Hi, good morning. I would like to get the guests' opinions on, like, Janesville here. We're growing and have been for over 15 years, prairie restoration projects, little pockets here and there. Given your comment that native species don't transplant well back into these, is it still worth the effort? Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. Dan, go ahead.
It absolutely is. So I was talking really about a limited subset of specialist prairie insects that maybe don't disperse well between sites, but we have boatloads of species that depend on diverse open space, whether that be prairie or woodlands, rare and declining species that are declining just because of general habitat loss or land use changes. Things like rusty patch bumblebee benefit greatly from prairie plantings. And they're good for the soil and water, so they're absolutely worth it.
I want to land here, Deborah, on funding. You mentioned you're now an accredited land trust. Are the Prairie Enthusiasts as an organization like seeking state or federal grants to further these projects?
We are, and we do. So we have been the grateful recipient of funding from the state and the federal government as well for some of the projects that we're doing, because especially we're working with, again, some really threatened species, sometimes endangered species on our sites. The state and the U.S. government has identified the importance of our work and invested dollars in supporting it. But equally important to us is growing the community of people that we have involved in this work. So actively seeking volunteers to do all sorts of different activities on our sites, from seed collecting to, as Dan mentioned, prescribed burning, even work within just the organization, communicating, that kind of thing. We really are a grassroots group, and we're committed to people who live in the local area, finding these places where they live, developing relationships with them, and becoming stewards of the land.
Well, thank you both for joining us and for sharing your work.
Thank you so much, Kate, for having us. It was fun. I hope we'll see some of your listeners at the conference.
Indeed. That is Deborah Behrens, the executive director of the Prairie Enthusiasts, and Dan Carter is its ecologist. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss criminal justice in Milwaukee County as its top prosecutor prepares to step aside after nearly two decades as district attorney. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story of a food tradition from a Caribbean island.
Cooking can transport us to another place, another time. When we cook, we're able to keep our family's dishes and memories alive for generation after generation. That's the case for Anne Marie Herman in Madison, who was raised on the island of St. Lucia. WPR's L. Malik Anderson brings us her story about fish cakes. It's part of the Wisconsin Life series, Food Traditions.
The smell of hot oil, jerk chicken, and freshly baked bread with coconut and chocolate chips. Bill Anne Marie Herman's kitchen in Madison. She heats up the oil in a large, heavy cast iron pan over her stovetop. Her ingredients wait on the countertop, ready to be put to work.
This is flour. This is the codfish. It has some thyme, onion, garlic, and other spices.
On the menu today, salted fish cakes. She fills the frying pan with as many battered fish cakes as she can at once. After they are all done, she takes them out of the pan and places them on top of a huge pile of more fish cakes. This dish has been a part of Herman's life for a long time.
I was born in the Caribbean islands, St. Lucia. But when I was much younger, I used to cook for my older brothers. That's how I started cooking, real cooking.
Herman grew up in the countryside with her mother and would go back and forth to the middle of the town to cook for her elder brothers who were taxi drivers.
My brothers were taxi drivers who were in the middle of town driving tourists and stuff, so they don't have time to do anything with cooking, so I used to do the cooking for them. But what my trick was not using a lot of fat in my food. I didn't use to measure a lot of stuff when I was cooking.
Herman started keeping track of her measurements for each dish when she decided to publish a cookbook of family favorite recipes with a Caribbean twist.
You see inside of it? It has all the Caribbean islands in there. That's my idea of putting the Caribbean foods together.
In her cookbook, she shares recipes for beef patties, fried green plantains, aloha friendship bread. There's also jerk chicken and other dishes her family enjoys.
Fish cakes is another thing I make often. You take codfish, you boil it because it has a lot of sodium in it. So you wash it first, then you put it in a little pot to boil, and then when you give it a few minutes to cook, when it softens, you wash it again. You put more cold water on it to take the salt. Then you shred it and you add spices to it.
She said her fish cakes are always a hit among her friends in the Caribbean Association of Madison.
Sometimes I even try to hide it but they find it before the meal, and some people will come and say, where is the fritters? They call it fritters. They ask me, where are the fritters you brought? It's there, but when you look, it's gone.
Saint Lucia, Helen of the West.
WPR producer L. Malik Anderson brought us that story on Anne-Marie Herman's Fish Cakes. And this story is part of a project from Wisconsin Life called Food Traditions. It's a multimedia exploration of food, culture, and identity, and can be found at wisconsinlife.org/foodtraditions. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're in conversation with Milwaukee County District Attorney John Chisholm on criminal justice issues and his legacy as he announces not to seek re-election after 17 years leading the DA's office. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. John Chisholm was first elected in 2006. First position in the office was as an assistant DA in 1994. Milwaukee County DA John Chisholm, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Nice to be with you.
Good morning. Why this moment? Why retire now?
You know, this is a moment where I have a strong feeling that some of the challenges that we faced in the last 3 years are starting to level out, and there's a equilibrium coming back to the system. There's an enormous amount of work to be done to build upon some of the processes that we believe will keep our community safe and still respect people's civil liberties and hopefully just create a healthier community. But all of those things have been tremendously challenged for the last 3-4 years with the public health crisis and other issues. And I just have a strong feeling that we're starting to stabilize, and this is a good time for me to move aside at the end of the year, and provides lots of time for people to select the next Milwaukee County District Attorney. And again, I just think at the end of the day, one of the things that should be modeled is that you serve your community and then you voluntarily step aside when you think it's the right time to do that.
So you say challenges are leveling out. Are there still any type of backlogs in your system? Are there still tension stress points that you're trying to deal with as an office?
No question about it. One of the successful things that we've been able to do using federal relief ARPA dollars is to actually increase our staff by about 14-15 assistant DAs, and that has helped tremendously to ease the backlog burden and get things back to a more normal state. Now that funding is going to expire at the end of the year. So again, it's our hope that what we see is that the case numbers return to roughly 2019 levels, and that we also see a corresponding reduction in the violent crime in the community. And again, last year is a good example of that. So at the worst moment of sort of the public safety, public health crisis, we had almost 215 homicides in the city of Milwaukee. You know, last year that dropped significantly down to about 170, still way too many. And I would like to get us to pre-pandemic levels. And I'm hopeful that we're going to get to that place again here in this coming year.
What key things are needed in order to get to pre-pandemic levels and reduce the gun violence?
Great question. And what it really comes down to in my experience, in my opinion, is that we have to continue our efforts to work very closely with the community and identify the problems early on. It's the classic public health model. You identify the problems early, you try to prevent them, you intervene intelligently when you see the problem emerging, and you rely on suppression as sort of a last resort. And through our community partnership, community prosecution model, we've been able to do that very successfully. We have a successful early intervention program for those suffering from mental illness, drug addiction. People have been exposed to significant trauma. The work we've done with the family violence approach, just radically changing our approach to dealing with victims of family violence through the Sojourner Family Peace Collaboration. All of these things are things that we can build upon. Ultimately, I'm convinced that the resources have to be pushed down to the community level, though. That's where the most successful interventions, all the studies, all the people that I've worked with throughout my career in the academic world will tell you that the most successful interventions is when you have the resources right down at the neighborhood, right at the community level, that they can apply to preventing these things from happening and successfully intervening and using the right dosage to treat the problem. We got to get our schools back up and running across the board, and we just have to have a close collaboration between our business, our faith community, and everybody focused on primarily on our young people in our community who are most at risk.
That requires a flow of funding, a flow of revenue, and there is a boost in the money that the state returns to local governments, known as shared revenue. Milwaukee seeing that boost in funding. You know, how will this additional revenue affect your office and what you see in the community?
Tremendous, and it goes right to your original question, and that is, why now? One of the reasons I'm moving on is that for the first time it'll be 18 years at the end of my term. This has been the most promising circumstance with respect to funding. The assistant DAs finally, after a very, very long time and really just a disastrous statewide policy on not funding prosecutors and public defenders, they've just started adequately addressing that issue this year. So hopefully I can still attract and retain these magnificent young attorneys that want to do public service in the right way. And the same is true for public defenders. So, and then the flexibility that's been given the county and the city to address public safety and other issues through increased revenue flexibility, that's just all hopeful. It's kind of a unique opportunity for us to start addressing some of these historical issues. And I'm not unaware of the fact that when these negotiations were taking place, there was a reflexive sort of a knee-jerk reaction from the conservatives to oftentimes take shots at the Milwaukee County DA's office for what I would consider completely inaccurate reasons, but it didn't matter. It's politics. And another opportunity for this community to move forward is to build upon the successes we have, but just take away this constant anti-Milwaukee, Milwaukee versus the state of Wisconsin mantra that you hear. And I think it's an opportunity to do that.
John Chisholm is district attorney of Milwaukee County, plans to not seek a fifth term as DA. Call in with a question, share thoughts along the way, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. After three decades prosecuting cases in the Milwaukee County District Attorney's Office, the top prosecutor, John Chisholm, plans to step aside at the end of his term as DA. And we discuss criminal justice issues, his legacy. You can be part of the conversation. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Andrew in Milwaukee is here. Andrew, hi, go ahead.
Hi there. Good morning. So I was wondering, If you had a magic wand and could change one issue facing Milwaukee County, what would it be and why?
Yeah, great question, Andrew. The magic wand is really to address kids that are just being raised in completely abusive, traumatizing, and neglectful circumstances. That's the root problem of the criminal justice system, and that is that we just routinely are asked to address problems that are really ultimately beyond the capacity of the criminal justice system when it comes to people that are suffering from mental illness, from trauma, from drug addiction, all of the things that can happen in circumstances where people are exposed over and over for both historical and immediate reasons to circumstances that are extremely constraining. And so that'd be the magic wand, is put the resources into early interventions for kids, make sure that our school systems are functioning the way they're supposed to function, and creating economic opportunities for people. At the end of the day, the criminal justice system will always have to respond to violent offenders. That's true no matter where you go in the country. But that really, in an ideal world, that would be all we do, is we address people that are actually hurting other people, and effectively address those issues as opposed to trying to deal with all of the other problems that simply get funneled into the criminal justice system because there is no other safety net.
Well, let's talk a bit about when you decide to prosecute, because last year an analysis by the Wisconsin Policy Forum found that Milwaukee prosecutors are pursuing criminal charges less often in response to cases submitted by police. Charge rate is down for felony and misdemeanor referrals since 2019. Why are prosecutors filing charges less often?
So there's a host of reasons for it, but at the heart of it is that there's simply as part of the overall reduction in resources, there's been a dramatic reduction in the number of law enforcement officers actually working on the streets every day. So the City of Milwaukee Police Department is a good example. They've dropped almost 400 police officers from the time I first took elected office. And so the quality of your investigation is going to be directly tied to how much time you can invest in it. And if you are absolutely overwhelmed, as they have been, with really serious violent crimes, you just don't have the time to focus on some of the very important but less aggravated cases. And that's what I think you've seen over time is, you know, our obligation at the end of the day is simply to charge cases that we can actually prove with evidence that meets the standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And we've always stuck to that. We don't back away from that. That's our ethical obligation. And so I think that plays a close role in it. So, again, it goes back to the issue of with more revenue flexibility comes the ability potentially to increase a focus on public safety. And that can be done in a number of ways. That doesn't mean that translates immediately into more cops on the street. But there are other things that people can do through violence intervention programs and others that collaborate closely with us and with the police that can help take some of that load off and let us then focus just on the serious cases.
I wonder, as you do focus on the serious cases, are prosecutors like yourself transparent enough about what factors would lead you to which charging decision or when not to prosecute at all? Is there enough transparency in the system?
Well, I have been kind of at the forefront of this issue, kind of in the country, as a matter of fact. If you look into my background, one of my first commitments was to invite an outside organization, it was the Vera Institute of Justice, to do a top-to-bottom, inside-out review of our office and its charging decisions, and to be very public about it. And the focus at the time was on racial disparities, but we've maintained that focus. We still have a public-facing website that allows people to look at our things. All the information that you mentioned in the Wisconsin policy report, we gave them. Because that's what we do. We track this information and we give it to them. We analyze it ourselves. And so, yeah, transparency, accountability, It's really important that not just the Milwaukee DA's office, but I would argue every prosecutor's office in the country ought to be doing the same thing.
Talking with Milwaukee County District Attorney John Chisholm. Call in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. A former president of the Wisconsin Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers has called our state's probation revocation system disastrous. Do you support the way this, you know, probation revocation, a person sent to jail for violating community supervision, and how it works in Wisconsin?
Yeah, another great question. And it just reflects on the fact that an effective justice system requires all parts of it to function collaboratively and effectively together. And I think the correctional system is experiencing the exact same constraints that law enforcement is facing up front that you're seeing with correctional officers in the prison system also. In other words, you've had to essentially do lockdowns because you don't have enough prison guards right now. The same is true with probation parole. If you have enormous caseloads and not enough people to supervise, then oftentimes people just default. You see it in the classrooms, you see it everywhere. People oftentimes just default to taking the safest course of action, at least on what it appears, and just moving towards revocation because you don't have the resources for intervention. That needs to change along with everything else. Again, in the ideal system, you do your time, you become reintegrated with the community, and you move on, you get to take care of your family, and you actually contribute to the community. For those individuals that commit offenses that aren't amenable to that, you know, serious violence offenses, they're probably not going to be coming back to the community for a long time. And that's certainly what we see with our sexually violent offenders, with the homicides, with the non-fatal shooters, the serious armed robbery cases. Those individuals are not coming back to the community for a really long time. And that's just the nature of our job.
In our final seconds together, what piece of advice would you give your successor?
Well, I have a very strong preference there, and that is that one of my obligations, it's just like when I was in the military, you always planned for the day that you weren't going to be there. And I believe I have an extraordinarily strong executive team. And the advice is the same reason that I stepped up to run. It's to retain the culture of integrity within the office. Do the right thing. Despite all the difficult things that you're going to be confronted with, you ultimately just have to make a principled and thoughtful and ethical decision on what you do with every case that comes before you. And if you do that, the rest of it works out.
DA John Chisholm, thank you for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
John Chisholm is Milwaukee County District Attorney, first elected in 2006. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A global songwriting challenge called Album Writers Month. It's underway with a goal to write 14 songs. We explore the craft of songwriting with a pair of Wisconsin musicians. And you can ask a question along the way, share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Katie Dahl is here, folk singer-songwriter and playwright in Door County. Her fifth album is called Seven Stones, and her musical, The Fisherman's Daughters, will be staged by Northern Sky Theater at Peninsula State Park. Katie, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And Beth Kelly is here, singer-songwriter and songwriting instructor in Madison, performing with her own band and others. New book out. It's called Embrace Your Authentic Songwriter. Beth, welcome.
Hello.
Hi. So, okay, here's where we're going to start. This week at the Grammys, singer-songwriter Tracy Chapman performing her 1988 hit, Fast Car with country artist Luke Combs. Let's hear that final chorus that brought a standing ovation.
I remember when we were driving in your car. Speed so fast, I felt like I was gone. City lights way out before. Mountain lights down around my shore. And I had a feeling that I belonged. I had a feeling I could be someone, be someone, be someone.
Okay, Katie, you first. You've had some feels here. How did this moment, you know, what did you think in this moment?
I mean, I couldn't think. I was overcome by feelings, but I've since thought about it. And I think, I mean, I'm amazed by the power of that song. What I felt was was grateful to be in a world where there are songs and proud to be a songwriter, because the power of Tracy Chapman leading, propelling the whole song with that amazing guitar riff that we all know. And the song, which is so not like a pop song, like it, you know, you don't, there are no rhymes. There are almost no rhymes in the whole song. You don't get the chorus until like 2 minutes into the song. And it is just, it's a song about poverty, you know, and trying to make it. So there's a lot that is not typical of a song that really gets a lot of credit in American music, mainstream culture. And I was just so overcome by feeling like, wow, songs, they're amazing.
Beth, what came up for you?
You know, that's so funny, because I think, I don't know if I was on your Facebook feed, Katie, but I saw someone post something on Facebook that they were just in tears after seeing that. And I had the exact same reaction. I actually watched it the next day on YouTube because I heard about it. And I was making dinner and I was listening to it in my headphones and I had to stop. I was weeping because it was just so beautiful. And I thought, what a amazing testimonial to the power of music and the power of songwriting, that two people from different backgrounds of different generations can come together in this musical moment and touch so many. It was just so powerful. And I've always loved that song. And I actually just learned it to play guitar behind another singer recently. And I guess it struck me even more when I studied the song, just how simple it is, but yet how powerful it is at the same time.
Simple and powerful. And Beth, you know, here we are in album writing month, and you are now in on this challenge to write the 14 songs before February is out. How does this challenge like spark creativity or maybe make you feel like having a pit in your stomach?
You know, it's funny. I actually feel my most vibrant and healthy when I am creating. And so it might sound stressful from the outside to try to write 14 songs in 28 days. But to me, as the end of January is approaching, I'm like, is it February yet? Is it February yet? Is it February yet? Because I just want to write and I want to unleash all this creative power. And I always have ideas coming to me, but I don't always take the time to sit down and complete those ideas and put them into a finished product. And I guess what's beautiful about February Album Writing Month is it's a website. If you go to FOM.org, there's people all over the world participating. So this morning I woke up and I wrote a lyric. I posted it and I said, hey, does anybody want to write music to this? Go for it. So I've collaborated with people I've never met. I actually co-wrote a song with someone from California that has, you know, really touched my heart. It's such a beautiful experience. So I love this month.
Katie, how are you at writing songs under the pressure of a deadline?
I mean, that's the only way I do it. I mean, I'll write like one or two songs when I'm not under a deadline. And then, but that's, you know, I've written, you know, I don't know, 60 or 70 songs in my life and almost, well, I guess 80 or 90, anyway, all of them under deadlines. And actually, I'm not doing this album writing month challenge, but I am writing a musical that I have a self-imposed deadline of March 6th for. So I feel the exhilaration and the necessary terror that comes from a deadline.
We're talking about songwriting with Door County folk singer Katie Dahl and Madison band leader and songwriting instructor Beth Killey. You can join in. Questions and comments, 800-642-1234. So, Beth, you know, you've coached aspiring songwriters for years, and now you've got a book, Embrace Your Authentic Songwriter. Like, what facets of songwriting do musicians need help with? Because I understand the working title of this book was about songwriter self-help.
Yeah, I know. Well, it was lovely, actually. So as the music director for Girls and Ladies Rock Camp, I've been teaching songwriters or aspiring songwriters, you know, people who maybe know nothing at all, have never written a song before, like, what are the basics of what you need to know? Mm. And, you know, sometimes I think the most basic information, just understanding a little bit about song structure. Like, there's repetition to songs, right? Like Tracy Chapman's song that we just heard a snippet of. You know, there's a verse, then there's a chorus, and then there's another verse with the same melody and the same chords, and then the chorus repeats. So it's like, I think sometimes people set out thinking, well, I want to write a song, but I have no idea where to start. And they have all these ideas and they don't know how to corral them. So one of the things that I try to give people up front is, hey, there's a scaffolding, there's structure to songs. And if you just plunk your ideas into this foundation, it makes your life a lot easier and it can help you sort of bring all these ideas together into one 3-minute song.
Like, that scaffolding gives comfort. It gives that structure of what you need to kind of do to make it happen. And that's really important to have that structure. But I mean, you've also said that, you know, songwriting, there are no rules, so you can throw
Absolutely.
That scaffolding away.
Yes. And actually, that's one of the things I talk about repetitively in the book, is that these are not rules. These are tools. And you should think of all of these ideas as something that when you get stuck in your process, you open up your toolbox, you pull out the tool that you need, you apply it. But there's so many, you know, things that you could apply that if you try to put all of the ideas in that book into one song, you'll drive yourself mad. So it's really just taking out what you need when you need it to get over the hurdle that you've hit in your process. Hmm. And then just letting your creativity flow and not thinking that you have to follow any kind of rules or, you know, there's no magic formula, but there are formulas that can help you.
It makes me wonder, Katie, in the formulas you look at and how you go about with your music. I mean, do you apply it differently when you're writing a musical like you are now versus when you're working on an album?
Totally. I mean, I think the thing about songs and musicals is usually they need to get you to a different place than you were in the beginning of the song. So a song in a musical tends to be less resolved because a song on its own, like a song that I write on an album, should exist, should be able to work in its own little 4-minute form, right? Like, you should be able to listen to that song and get something from it. And it's great if it can have context, but the context isn't is necessary to it. But in a musical, you really need to move from point A to point B. Everything needs to be sort of about moving the story forward and moving the character forward. And so things like repeated choruses, often a chorus will change from chorus to chorus because we need to show movement. Or often there are bridges are a musical theater writer's best friend because it's a big change in the structure of the song that can, you know, sort of presage a big change in the character's life or in the character's thinking. So
like a mood shift even. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And sometimes even like a bridge at the end, which is something that you would rarely do in a song, in a musical theater song is sometimes just the thing, you know? Hmm.
Katie Dahl and Beth Kelly, they are singer-songwriters based in Door County and Madison, respectively. Share what's on your mind about songwriting. Call in with the question. You can add your perspective, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As musicians across the world and in Wisconsin write new lyrics and rough out melodies during album writing month, We discuss the craft of songwriting, and you can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Madison-based singer-songwriter, music producer, and songwriting instructor Beth Killey is here. And Katie Dahl is a folk singer-songwriter and playwright in Door County. Katie, you've written songs rooted in place and specifically the peninsula of Door County, and you're now writing and performing songs that are more personally revealing. And we're going to hear a sample now of When I Was Eight from your album Seven Stones.
I'm not the kind of girl who cares what anybody else might say. I only hate myself a few dozen times a day. And then a few dozen more for feeling that way. Get hit by the bullet and the ricochet. It's a game I don't know how not to play. How does anybody learn to say,
I don't want to jump in here, Katie. Let's just keep listening, right? So what are you contemplating and conveying in this song?
This is a song about sort of my lifelong struggles with body image, which I don't think are unique. You know, I think a lot of us have these problems, especially women, but not only. And so the first line of that song is, I've been trying to lose weight since I was eight. And it's a song about seeing a picture. The first time I saw a picture of my body and didn't like what I saw, and I tore it up and threw it away. And it's sort of a contemplation that goes on from there.
How are audiences responding to these songs compared to your other works?
I would say that these songs are really getting a lot of feedback that feels really personal to me. Like people are really, I heard someone say once, you know, the more specific you are, the more universal you are, and that really has borne out for me. Like I think when I've been talking about these really personal struggles, I get people coming up to me and at the merch table and crying and saying, you know, I get that, or I'm going to play that for my daughter, or, you know, I really have found like a sense of community and connection with these other people by talking about things that maybe we wouldn't normally talk about as strangers or even as close friends sometimes. Mm-hmm.
Beth, can we talk candidly about feedback on songwriting and how to apply it? Because, I mean, you have this thing called the Nashville Hammer, and I would hope you could elaborate on feedback.
Yes, yes. Well, first of all, I just want to say, Katie, that song is gorgeous. I do want to hear the rest of it eventually. But yes, you know, feedback is an interesting thing, and my big take home for the readers of my book is that it's all about intention and purpose. Why are you writing this song? And who is it for? And what is your voice? And what do you have to say? And if you've put your heart out there, said what you wanted to say, you're saying it in the way you want to say it, and it makes you feel something, that's all that really matters. And so this Nashville Hammer concept was something that I came up with as just kind of a funny term in my own head for the feedback that I would hear people get sometimes when they would seek out advice on how to write their songs from people who were trying to write for the row, meaning music row in Nashville. And, you know, country songs have a certain structure generally. There's, you know, a certain language that a lot of country artists use. It's very straightforward language. It's not really poetic or flowery. It doesn't mean it's not clever, but it's just, it's a specific style of writing. And so people would come to meetings to get critiques on their songs and would get this feedback for their song that was maybe, you know, for their grandmother about how to make the song better. But in the mind of the critiquer, they're like, oh, well, you want to pitch this song to some publisher in Nashville who's going to hand it off to Carrie Underwood to make it the next big hit. And that wasn't the intention of that song at all. Mm-hmm. So I watched songwriters walk away with their tail between their legs, feeling deflated about this thing that they put out there, but the person who was giving them advice had no clue what their intention was. And so I feel like it's important for us as writers and us as people who are supporting writers to understand that purpose.
I think what I took away too is that, you know, when you have a hammer in your hand, not everything around you is a nail.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes.
Well, Beth, let's hear one of your songs. And you identify this as an anthem, All Is One. It's a track from your 2023 Beth Kelly Band album, This Open Road. Let's listen. Okay, so why is thinking of a song in one or more of categories helpful to songwriting?
Well, I personally find it helpful, again, for that sense of purpose, like what is the function of this song in the mm-hmm. world? But also as a writer, sometimes it helps to reflect on your catalog as a whole and think, you know, if I want to diversify my catalog a little bit, is everything I'm writing an anthem, or is everything I'm writing a love song, or is everything I'm writing a breakup song? So, you know, it can help you both in where to go with your next song and how to think about the purpose of your current song.
And you might surprise yourself, right? I mean,
oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's the beauty of it. Sometimes I start out trying to write something for some reason, and then I'll get a little idea or a word or a metaphor will pop into my head, and I'm like, ooh, I'm going to follow that. So it's perfectly, you know, valid to follow the butterflies and the shiny things and be distracted by squirrels.
Katie, what do you think about that in terms of stretching out and trying different forms in your songwriting and in melodies?
I mean, I think it's great. And I think, like, that we all songs exist in this sort of currency of music that we, particularly as American listeners, but beyond that too, that we understand. And I think to think about, like, where does this fit in the currency? How will this land on people? Like, I heard the songwriter Farron, who's a great songwriter, talk once about, like, when you put an image in your song, you're inviting a certain spirit of that image into the song. Like, if you put a door into your song, you're putting the spirit of the door in the song, and that comes with this whole set of associations that we as listeners know, you know. And that sometimes that spirit is really big and kind of takes over the song, and you need to get rid of it. But sometimes it brings with it so much more than just that image. And I think that's the same with genre and form. Like, oh, we kind of know what an anthem is, and it carries a lot of potency that we don't even have to put into that particular song, because we know how that feels in our body, you know, as a listener.
And every word has intention, right? I mean, it can evoke something, and maybe evoke something differently for you versus someone else who's listening, a fan.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, and it does. I'm always surprised to hear people's
interpretations.
People's reflected interpretations of my songs. Like, huh, that's not what I thought it was about.
We are learning about techniques in songwriting with musicians Katie Dahl in Door County and Beth Kelly in Madison. Call in with a question. You can share comments at any point, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As the music industry evolves with expanding genres and platforms like TikTok creating that closer connection to artists, we examine the craft of songwriting during Album Writing Month when some musicians take on that challenge to write 14 new songs. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Katie Dahl is a folk singer-songwriter and playwright in Door County, and her fifth album is called Seven Stones. Beth Killey is here, Madison-based singer-songwriter. New book out is called Embrace Your Authentic Songwriter. Beth, you credit the musical tastes of your parents as being influential. And when you were growing up, you listened to music they loved, including Dan Fogelberg. And so at the risk of being a bit emotional here, we're going to hear a snippet of Leader of the Band.
A quiet man of music denied a simple fate. He tried to be a soldier once, but his music wouldn't wait. He earned his love through discipline, a thundering velvet hand. His gentle means of sculpting souls took me years to understand. The leader of the band is tired and his eyes are growing old.
Oh, Beth, tell us what moves you.
I love that song. It's the very last line of the last verse in that song that every time I hear it, I burst into tears. It's, Papa, I don't think I've said I love you near enough. Mm-hmm. And it just, I think because my parents were such amazing, influential, creative supporters in my life that it evokes so many beautiful emotions for me. I love Dan Fogelberg's voice and his guitar playing. My mom played his records all the time when I was growing up. So that's just a beautiful song.
Oh, I love that. Katie, are there songs in your life that really propel you back to listening as a kid and in childhood?
Oh, yeah. I mean, my mom, especially like Mary Chapin Carpenter, who is, you know, sort of like a, has a reputation as a country star, but is really like a folk songwriter underneath, I think. And we listened to that. We listened to a lot of Alison Krauss growing up. And I also just grew up loving the musicians I heard at Northern Sky Theater, which is, I'm now associated with, which was kind of like a music theater hybrid, which is cool because I've grown into a weird music theater hybrid myself. So
that evolution there. But you know, I think people are changing. We're now, you know, there weren't phones in people's hands during Leader of the Band days. And
right.
Yeah. And so I'm just wondering, like, have our attention spans changed, or how do you handle like brevity in songwriting, Beth?
I really do think our attention spans have changed. I know mine has changed. But, you know, it's funny, even though sometimes I am concerned about that, but that Tracy Chapman song at the beginning of this whole piece of this radio show that we played with Luke Combs, I mean, that's a long song. And as Katie pointed out, the chorus of that song doesn't hit until 2 minutes into the song. So I think that when you tap someone's heartstrings in the right way and you draw them into your story and into that moment, you can capture their attention again.
I also think, too, is that how you think about that every song idea, it can be just a song. I mean, it doesn't have to be poignant, or it doesn't have to be a cure-all.
Yeah.
And
exactly.
You can just, like, give permission to create a song no matter what. And can you speak to that ability just to write a song because it's a song?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, that I just like to have fun with songwriting. I mean, probably my most requested song is a song that I wrote about how much I love lip balm. And so it's the most ridiculous song I've ever written, but it's the one that people, I mean, they're waving their chapstick in the air when I sing that song. And I think you know, I kind of set the song up like it's about addiction. And then when I get to that chorus and I start singing about chapstick, people lose their minds because they're, you know, first of all, they're surprised, but also they're like, I'm addicted to chapstick too. Or they're like, oh, my sister, or my brother. So they know someone or they themselves. So if people can relate to your song, it doesn't matter if it's the cure-all for everything and, you know, the most emotional, like leader of the band, Dan Fogelberg type song. I mean, you can touch people with humor and levity and all sorts of different emotions. We all feel all of these.
But you get that vibrancy, though, in a live environment where people are waving that chapstick. And I wonder, Katie, I mean, you perform in cafes and restaurants where there are patrons and other things happening than the performer. What do you take away from those environments, and how do you choose songs to play in these environments versus in strictly concert settings?
Yeah, you know, I don't really play those cafes and restaurants anymore. I sort of, because I was finding it hard, I sort of have shifted to really playing only in listening settings. And that is a gift and has really affected the way I write. I write to be listened to, whether it's a funny song about like a lazy Susan and a dumb waiter falling in love, or it's like a serious song about, you know, lifelong body image struggles. But I think what I did learn, you know, when playing in all those cafes and restaurants, which is what I did for the first several years of my career, taught me so much about how to be comfortable on stage, you know, just putting the hours in to feel, to be able to feel like standing in front of the microphone is a home rather than like a scary cliff, is half the 90% of the battle, really, because after that you can be yourself, and hopefully who yourself is likable or at least is engaging.
It's interesting too. I mean, I would imagine then you get over that stage fright right away because, you know, you're with an audience in such an intimate setting. You can see the expression on their faces as you play a song. Does that affect you?
Well, I mean, I would say that is a blessing and a curse that you can see the expression on their faces. I mean, some people's listening faces when they're in a concert are not the same as people's listening faces when they're in a conversation. Like, I don't think they know that I can see them sometimes. So, you know, they're like listening. They're not supposed to be, you know, having anything on their face other than whatever is naturally happening. But you can get in your head. But I you know, I would say that the stage fright, like some of the songs that I have been playing lately that are scarier to play, I would say I have felt really shaky on stage for the first time in years. Like before I play one of those songs that feels vulnerable, I have for the first few times I felt really like scared in this way that I hadn't for years.
Oh, wow. Beth, what do you do when you have those types of emotions as you approach a song and perform it?
Yeah, you know, that vulnerability piece is so huge. And I think I've tried to adopt the philosophy that all audiences are friendly audiences. And I love your comment about people not knowing what their faces look like, because that's so true. And I've had, you know, people I've approached after shows that, you know, were looking at me like with a really strange expression that come up and say, oh, that was a great show. And I was like, wow, because you were looking at me like I had
like
some
I
strange marks on my right, exactly. But no, I do. It's funny. Usually I feel very comfortable on stage, but when I'm performing new music, that's when the nerves kick in and I it's good to remember that space, though, and to feel that fear and to walk through it. And, you know, we all have discomfort in our lives, but it's good to know that every song that I play that I'm comfortable with was at one point a song that was new to me. So I feel I can get through it, but it's it can be a little nerve-wracking at times.
It reminds me, one of my favorite songwriters, Jeff Black, he's, forgive him, based in Nashville, but he was in a coffee shop in Marshall, Texas, and he told us, and we were, listening in this coffee shop, and there is stuff going on. And he said, you know, I take my glasses off when I perform, so you are all totally blurry to me. And I've always, like, tucked that away, you know, in my head. I was like, oh, wow, he just gave me some some really interesting insight into how he does this on the road. And yeah, I don't know. I like that moment. Well, let's talk about collaborating. And Katie, you co-wrote a couple of songs on Seven Stones with piano and accordion player Julie Wolf, who also produced the album. What is your approach to collaborating with other songwriters?
You know, I haven't done a lot of collaboration with other songwriters, and the work I did with Julie on this record was really transformative, because Julie has a really people might know Julie from her work with Indigo Girls or Ani DeFranco. She was on the road with them for a number of years. And what she brings into the room is this amazing sense of delicacy and respect for the song. And she makes the tiniest moves to really shift songs or open them up or take away barriers. In the songs that ended up being called co-writes on this record, in both cases, I wrote them myself and then brought them to Julie for her feedback. And she ended up making changes that were not wholesale, but that were significant enough that they warranted her being credited as a co-writer. And I feel so glad to have someone that I feel safe enough to invite into that world that feels really personal to me. So that was what that collaboration was like.
And Beth, you play in three different bands. How different is that songwriting process for each of them?
Yeah, well, it's funny. I always joke that co-writing is kind of like dating, where you're not going to be compatible with everybody that you go on that first date with. And sometimes it's a matter of just finding the people that you click with. And, the songs on the Beth Kelly Band albums are primarily written by me. I bring them to the band. The band adds their pieces, and sometimes we'll tweak a chord or a word here or there. But those are largely, my voice, my words. Gin, Chocolate, and Bottle Rockets is my trio. We've co-written many songs together, and that's, just a very beautiful space to be in. I mean, Jen Farley and Sean Del Mar, my bandmates in those bands, I just have so much love and respect for them that we just have to hold each other in the right space, if you will, in that safe, it's okay to be vulnerable, it's okay to put your heart out there kind of environment when we co-create.
Singer-songwriters Beth Kelly of Madison, Katie Dahl of Door County, giving us insights into their musicianship. Be part of the conversation about songwriting. Call in with a question, add thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about the craft of songwriting and what it makes a song stand out when on Spotify that's home to more than 100 million tracks. Call in with a question. Share thoughts on songwriting. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. What a pleasure. We have singer-songwriters Katie Dahl in Door County and Beth Kelly of Madison. Katie, one of your newer songs is called Sacristy, and the song addressing your coming of age as a queer person while attending an evangelical church.
Back then I thought that we were serpents. I thought we brought the flood. Thought we turned water into blood. I thought we drank a wicked wine. But really you were an apple. Me, I was a dove, eating manna from above. I guess you knew that all the time.
The So, Katie, you know, I think of the sacristy as a place in the church you just don't go. You don't venture there.
But, that's right.
But here, you know, you do. You name it. This is the title of the song. What, you know, how can you explain why you go this direction?
Yeah, well, no, I can't. It's a big mystery. You know, I grew up, like you said, evangelical. I grew up like Swedish Baptist. Mm. And mysteriously, all the imagery in that song became very Catholic. And I have no idea. That is a big old mystery of the song, of the muse. Other than that, like, I think the reason is that there's so much potency. You know, I was talking earlier about like what images carry with them. And I think there's a lot of potency in like wine and, you know, we didn't have wine at the Baptist church. We had grape juice, right? But there's like the wine and the father, and like, we didn't have fathers, we had pastors, but that doesn't sound as beautiful, right? So I didn't intend to do that, but it just sort of happened that it transformed. And I think the sacristy, like, that's a big mystery too. I don't know how I know that word. Like, we didn't have that in our church. But you know, things burrow into your subconscious and then they come out, which is an amazing trick of the artistic process. And it's really a miracle.
I love how you end on that word miracle. That's good. Beth, you know, just say what's on your mind here. What comes up?
Well, you know, the first thing I was thinking of when you were talking about how the song became Catholic, that there are some words that look great on paper, but they don't sound wonderful when they are sung out of your mouth. So that's mm-hmm. something that I try to impress on people in the writing process too, is that, you know, they think they have to be very accurate, or they have to be, you know, I don't know, speaking complete sentences, but it's a song and it's to melody, and the music tells part of the story as well. And so, you know, choosing the word father over pastor, that makes total sense to me as a songwriter, even though it's not, you know, specific to your specific mm-hmm. past, mm-hmm. it makes total sense. And it paints the right picture, and it takes people on this beautiful journey. I totally get why that happened. It's because it happens to me all the time, and I give it permission.
Well, I think, you know, sacristy could be applied to your spider writing exercise, Beth. Like, you put a word, and then you branch out from that word.
Yes, I love doing this exercise when we're group writing. I've done like all of these ridiculous, 45-minute random workshops over the years with people where it's like, okay, we've got 30 people in this room, we're going to write a song in 45 minutes, let's go. So we put some random word in the middle of the page, put a circle around it, and then I just ask people, shout out whatever the first thing that comes to your mind, and I draw around, you know, off from that center circle a little leg of a spider, and I put the next word they think of, and then we keep putting more legs on that body, just to come up with a bunch of ideas. And what's fun and beautiful about that is, you know, taking this exercise that someone taught me somewhere along the line, is that you get all these metaphors. You know, you take what was your central idea, and then you just keep building on it. And sometimes you have ideas that seem disconnected, but they work together.
Does it work? Does this exercise help?
Oh, absolutely. I think so. I mean, you know, not every single song it forms this way. And I think I do this in my brain now without writing it on the paper. But when you're trying to, you know, bring a group of people that are writing all on the same page, you literally want to write it on a page that everyone can see, so they can kind of see each other's ideas and where other people's brains are going. So yes, it has worked for group writing exercises for me in the past.
And you work with young people through Girls and Ladies Rock Camp Madison, and you've also worked with kids overcoming abusive behavior that's continued through generations. And as a tribute to them, you wrote End of the Line.
Daddy had a heavy hand, just like his father and his father's old man. And it was all Joey knew, but he knew it was wrong. Joey turned 17. One day daddy raised his fist. Joey blocked it with his arm. Said, let me tell you this. I know that's all you know to do, but I'm not like you. This is the end of the line.
Beth, what do you take away from your time spent with young people?
Well, for Girls Rock Camp, these campers routinely blow my mind with what they can do in a week's time. You know, the camp is for 8 to 18-year-olds. They show up, we put an instrument in their hand, we teach them how to play it. They form a band with four people they just met and write a song on an instrument they just learned. And then they show up at a showcase on Saturday and perform it for hundreds of screaming fans. And it's just so brave and so inspiring to see the way that they work together. And I want them to take home the message that this is the way the world can work. Now take what you've learned here and go forth and spread the news, because songwriting is a beautiful metaphor for just collaborative work in general. So I love working with kids. They've taught me so much, and I'm just grateful for them showing up to camp and sharing their gifts.
Katie, what advice do you share with aspiring songwriters?
You know, the advice that helped me the most as a young songwriter was from a songwriter named Michael Smith. He was a Chicago writer, and I heard him say, like, you know, when you're young, you'll want to ask a lot of other people, is this good? Is this okay? Like, you'll really crave affirmation outside yourself. And he said, you know, if you get quiet, you know if it's good or not. You know, and by good, I think he didn't, you know, you'll know if it's right or not. You'll know if it says what you want to say. And I think that is the advice that I'm still living into, that I wish I could have sort of believed more fully earlier, because I think it allows for true self-expression and real creativity from a deep place.
Sometimes you just have to sit with a song for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah. This has been such a wonderful conversation. Thank you both for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Thank you for having us.
That is Beth Kelly, Madison-based singer-songwriter, songwriting instructor, performing in several bands, new book out as well, Embrace Your Authentic Songwriter. Katie Dahl as well, independent singer-songwriter, playwright based in Door County. Her fifth album, Seven Stones, came out in 2023. Her musical, The Fisherman's Daughters, will be staged this summer, Peninsula State Park. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.